Ireland's Classic Hits Radio. It's Trina Mara. I am delighted to be joined by Ireland's number one best-selling true crime author, Mr. Paul Williams. Hello, Paul. How are you?
Hello, Trina. It's lovely to talk to you.
Sure, I'm seeing your face all over the bookshops at the moment. The latest book is out and it's called Crooks. How do you have so many stories in you?
Well, I suppose, by the way, it's the 13th book I've written, so I'm sincerely hoping and praying that it's lucky in this case. But you see, I started in the job this time 40 years ago as a young cub reporter in Leitrim, and I came to Dublin. I worked for a few years in the provinces, and then I came to Dublin to the Sunday World in 1987, where I worked until 2010 before I moved to the News of the World. So in that period of time, I covered an awful lot of stories and encountered an awful lot of people. And I suppose the real reason when I started writing the book was to go through the fact that what it was like to witness seminal events that changed the organised crime and created and moulded the kind of organised crime that we have today. Because for within that 40 years, 30 years of it was spent intensely covering crime. And I don't do frontline stuff like that anymore. And it was a time of great change because, like, when I came to Dublin first in 1987, a guy called The Monk, who was just about 2 years older than me, he made his big national debut as the biggest armed robber in the history of the state about 2 weeks before I joined the Sunday World. So our careers have sort of shadowed each other ever since, and I've written quite a lot about him, including the book specially dedicated to him. John Gilligan was on the go, and of course the General was on the go. So it was a crime-rich environment. So I found myself being sucked into that world gradually, and it was very exciting. It was very, very interesting. I started studying criminology on the back of it as well because I found it all very fascinating. And then, you know, so many things happened and with the General and all these guys. And then in 1996, Veronica Guerin was murdered. And that changed my life, and it certainly changed the lives of quite a lot of media people in Ireland because it was a shocking precedent that had been set. And then 4 years later, and about 5 years later, a great colleague and friend of mine from the Sunday World, Martin O'Hagan from the North, he was shot dead by a UVF drug gang. And purely those two colleagues of ours and friends were murdered in the line of duty while they were doing their jobs, because they did their jobs and did their jobs very well. So
at that point, Paul, did you not think to yourself, right, this job is just too dangerous. What am I doing here? I've got kids, I've got, you know, a family. What am I doing?
You see, it sort of creeps up in you. It's incremental. By the time I found myself in the real midst of serious, serious bother, but they were going to murder me in 2003. There was a guy going to murder me in 1996. Another one, they started the first time there was a serious threat to my life was in 1994. And I counted about 15, 16 serious incidents in that period of time that I had records of. But it doesn't just suddenly happen. And you don't suddenly decide, well, I'm going to go into this business because it's dangerous. I'm going to take risks. It just gradually happens. And you're in the middle of it. And there was never an issue, and especially when two colleagues were murdered, there was never an issue about backing away from it, because what drives reporters, not just me, all reporters, especially crime reporters, because we meet every day the raw realities and the harsh realities, the cruel realities and the dark side of life. So in that, we meet armies of dozens and scores of innocent people who have been victimized and their lives turned upside down, people belonging to the murdered, people who are addicts being beaten and bullied, people being raped and attacked, and it's not crusading and it's not vocational to say this, but you really do become sort of personally involved. And if you stop writing about these guys, if they can intimidate journalists, they can intimidate everybody. And that's why the murder of Veronica Guerin particularly was such a seminal and seismic event in our history, our social history, because here we had Veronica represents the media. The media represents one of the pillars, important pillars of our freedom of our society, a democratic society. And if you undermine that, and if you take away the ability of the media to operate, and if people like us stop telling the stories, then the people, ultimately our democracy suffers. Now, people say that's all idealistic nonsense, but that's the code by which I've lived by, and that's the code which a lot of my colleagues live by as well. And so therefore, it was never an option about saying, oh, I've had enough of this, I'm leaving it. It's just, the thing piles in on top of you. You get yourself in a situation, and the only way to do is navigate out. Because if you back down to bullies and thugs, then they just come after you anyway. Because they're bullies and thugs, they're cowards, and cowards love sensing fear in others. Like, criminals are predatory creatures. They're always looking for the weak spot in anybody. And they love terrorizing people. That's their stock and trade. And, you know, we had these debates in the Sunday World back in the day when it was at its most intense. And when I went to the News of the World, it was the same discussion was had. But the one thing was that in the end of the day, even if I was in trouble, and like we were protected by the Garda Síochána for many, many years. Like, you know, the reason I'm alive today, of course, is to be thankful to Garda Síochána, because they protected me and my family from the very first major threat my life was in 1994, right up to less than 10 years ago. And we had full-time police protection. I had bodyguards at one stage for 2 years. So I was protected and my family were protected and they were safe. Because the state decided, they said, we're going to impose this because your life is seriously a threat. Okay, so that was dealing with. So I had to learn how to deal with that. And it was a great, you know, invasion of our lives and my family's lives. But then it meant I continued to do my bloody job.
You could never go on a holiday or, you know, do the school run in a normal way or go to the supermarket in a normal way.
I've often done the school run in a normal way, yeah. Like, there were just many years. There was, I suppose, the most intense period. Again, this is sort of like history in the making, because after Veronica was murdered, gangland violence dropped quite a lot. And then with the Criminal Justice Bureau introduced after her murder, it gave fellows like me an opportunity to use the law that existed to expose more and more criminals, because the CAB were exposing guys. And they operated in what's called the civil burden of proof, which meant that it protected us legally from libel actions. Because these guys would sue you as quick as the drop of a hat.
Yeah.
And trying to stop people from going to court to give evidence against them and all that kind of thing. So that gave us an opportunity to go after them. But then we saw the evolution. Again, I wrote this in the book. I talked about this gang I discovered, which I put the nickname on, of the Westies, in 1999. And they were the first of the new generation of narcos that now are here, and we take them as for normal and for granted in our society. But they brought a new level of violence and also a new level of prosperity to the business, because from the late 90s on, the business of drugs in this country boomed. And on the back of that, gangs mushroomed all over the place. And the way that they did business was to use the guns on each other and to attack and murder anybody got in the way. And that's why, like in 1993, where there were three gangland murders I covered, in 2003, there was over 20 gangland murders in the Republic of Ireland, most of them in Dublin and the rest in Limerick. It became a crime-rich environment, a story-rich environment. There was just so much to write about. And on average, I was doing over half the front pages every year in the Sunday World, year in, year out, for years. And the reason half of those, again, were nearly every week, or every, say, 15, 20 weeks in the year, we were doing on average one big background story on the latest gangland murder. When I look back on it and went through all the stuff that I covered through the years, you wonder, to God, it was just frenetic. It was non-stop.
Yeah.
And it was also exciting, and it was rewarding.
I'm sure, yeah.
It could be scary. It could be, you know, very, very emotional and all of that. But it was full on. But that was the job.
Well, you paid very, very well, Paul, because I know there's, for example, you know, cameramen who are being sent to war-torn countries, and there's a special website for recruiting media staff for these dangerous jobs in these various countries, and the pay is really, really high, because there is such a risk to your life. Would you have been paid very well because it was a risky job that you were doing?
Well, I paid fairly well, but by the way, I would totally differentiate myself or any of my colleagues here in Ireland compared to what people are doing abroad. Like, they're doing really, really serious, heavy-duty, dangerous stuff. We're in a domestic market. In fact, we're still relatively innocent-looking compared to what some of those other journalists are faring. Like, how many journalists around the world have been murdered so far this year alone? It's become a regular phenomenon. So many of them have been murdered in Gaza, you know? But there'll be no comparison, really. But yes, you did get paid well. But then I had all kinds of problems being a bit, as a result of my job. I couldn't get life insurance for my mortgage. At one stage, the people who were selling me our dream home, we found a lovely new home that we wanted to move to. And initially, the people who were selling it to us blocked it and said, we can't sell to you. And the reason that was pure fear, and this is the effect of fear, and I did a couple of chapters a bit after the book about the cost of fear and how a fear, how insidious it is and how it creeps into society. Uh-huh. Like, I couldn't get insurance on my car. People didn't want to allow their kids to babysit for us for years because, and when we didn't
get kids, in case something happened, no one wants to be Paul Williams' next door neighbour kind of thing.
That is a fact.
Yeah.
And we fairly always paid our babysitters, and we did get really good babysitters. We paid them extremely well. But that was another thing that happened. When I had a bomb scare at my home, 150 of my neighbours were evacuated at 3 o'clock in the morning on a cold November morning, this time of year. And the thing about that was by organized crime to make a pariah of me and my community. But I was incredibly ashamed and upset that had happened to my neighbors. And never forgot it.
What did the neighbors say to you, Paul? Were they like, come on now, like, or were they supportive of you?
The neighbors found themselves, I went around to say, basically apologized to them that time individually. And, you know, they said, we understand you have a job to do. Now, they had been living beside me at that stage for a good few years. A lot of them that were living beside me, we were there 14 years when this happened, and for a long time the police car, the squad cars, have been up and down past our home anyway, you know, one side of it wasn't. There were no burglaries in the area. And certainly one for 15 years we were there. But people were annoyed as well. And I'd explained to them, you know, I certainly didn't set out to attract these people to come and do this kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it was a very awkward conversation.
But I'm sure, because they're probably worried about their kids out playing on the road if they got in a crossfire or something, or, you know, you would worry,
yeah,
I'm sure.
That's what organised crime is about. It's about creating fear, and it's about creating these kind of problems for everybody, you know. And all of that, but you have to remember as well that they wouldn't have come after us, me or the Sunday World or any of the other employers I work for, or tried to kill me if I wasn't doing something, you know, that was really pissing them off. And that means we were telling the public stories they did not want anybody to know.
Where were you getting the information from, Paul? Were there people, snitches or whatever you call them, were there people around them that were actually telling you bits and pieces?
Yeah, but that's always the subject I'm very touchy about. We had really good connections with law enforcement, legal profession, and the criminal underworld. People come to you in the criminal underworld, one, because they want to cause problems for a rival or somebody else, and you'd always be watching for all of that and be very conscious of it. They also come forward because they say, these guys are getting out of control, this is evil, I didn't sign up for this. That's what so many guys said to me, you know, and you had to protect them. And then there were informants that put us right into the middle of organizations like the Kinahan gang. And in fact, we had a guy at one stage, a person very, very, very well connected, who was so good that the guards informally came and asked me, could they talk to this person? Because they knew we were getting information, very high quality intelligence on these people. And that person, ultimately that person disappeared into the system and was met with various security agencies to discuss the kind of, that's a long time ago now, and I couldn't really say much more about it because
fine,
I was going to write about it in the book, but I had to pull back from that because even now, at this stage, I didn't want my name was life in danger. But that was the kind of example of one of the things we did. And we paid that person in the sense that we paid their expenses, and we also paid them some money that they asked for because they were putting their lives at risk, giving us bona fide information, and the information was rock solid. And shall we say the source was rock solid in that the source was not classified, because I know this person was examined by various law enforcement agencies, not just the Gardaí, that this person was seen as a clean pair of hands in the sense that they were not involved in the actual criminality. So they were in position to provide information. So, and sometimes we had to, through the years, you know, pay for somebody to move, or, you know, not move to home, but to leave the country. If they needed money to get out of the country, we'd give them the money to get out of the country if, as a result of our work, they were under danger and they felt that they were in danger. It's a very dirty business in the sense that it's not a clean black and white world. It's a very grey world. You then hone your own psychological skills around all of that, because you have to understand what you're dealing with, you have to understand the people, and you get to read people, and you can read who's genuine, who's not. You can read the motivations. And like another category of people, of course, are the victims themselves who come and talk. And the reason they wanted to talk is because they wanted the world to know what they were up against and what happened to them. And that's important. Again, that's what we do in the media. We tell the world what's going on.
Paul, I was just looking at the age profile there last night of the start of all this. I guess kind of around the 80s and that, there was quite a few kind of murders around Dublin in particular. And the age profile of people that are involved in these gangs seem to be a lot older then than they are now. They seem to be getting younger and younger, aren't they?
Yeah, and that is another thing, by the way, in terms of the drug trade. The older villains, the so-called ordinary decent criminals, the guys of Jerry Hutch's ilk, they would look on these new criminals, to call them the new criminals, I call them narcos, the guys that started emerging with the Westies. A lot of these, they would look down the nose at them as just thugs and scumbags. That's what the word they say. They use themselves, the older criminals, because these young thugs never learned. They would view it, I suppose, the same way we do in every business or profession. We view our colleagues in a certain way, what's their experience level, what have they been trained in, what are they skilled in. These guys would look at these drug dealers as just being opportunistic criminals who just...
Right, so the amateurs, they're not the real ones. Right, okay.
Yeah. But they look down their nose at them. And I do know that the likes of Jerry Hutchin, that a lot of these guys, when his nephew started going to school and got involved with the Kinahans, like his class of criminal didn't want anything to do with this stuff, because these new criminals are volatile, nasty psychopaths who just, they're all psychopaths, but these guys, the drug trade seemed to bring out the worst in a new generation, and you're right. And they're grooming children as well, Trina. They started this in Limerick, and it's going on, it's now systematic, that gangs right across this city and right across the country groom young kids to do the dirty work for them, to move guns, to move drugs, collect money, because they know those kids aren't going to be done. And also the kids won't open their mouths because they're groomed and framed.
I witnessed it, Paul, in broad daylight there about 2 weeks ago in Summerhill, and these literally kids, I'd say they were about 13 or 14 on their scooters, you know, and they're all on the electric scooters, and an open drug deal going on in front of the line of traffic. They don't care. They don't care if anyone's watching.
No. They don't care at all. No, you know, they don't care. And you have to remember as well, there was a funeral for a thug called Maguire a couple of years ago, which really was shocking. I mentioned this in the book as well, because my career started, the first story I ever covered was War and Crime. This guy was a criminal going around the country terrorizing people in their homes. You may recall a couple of years ago, his funeral during the lockdown turned into a spectacle where he was killed. He was burned to death along with two other guys when they drove down the motorway the wrong way and crashed into a truck after coming from a crime spree in the country. You know, they did. His so-called friends and associates all celebrated his life as a criminal, celebrated the fact that he spent his life terrorizing people in their homes, brought his number one and most favorite tool of choice, which was a screwdriver. And he used the screwdriver to terrorize old people in their homes. And he used this line, you know the score, get on the floor. Now, those nasty, predatory bastards brought his screwdriver up to the altar of the church as one of the mementos of his life, to celebrate his life.
Oh my God.
This was the tool of his trade. And they did floral tributes in the form of screwdrivers. Like, when you saw that, you wouldn't have seen that 10 years ago. You certainly wouldn't have seen it 20, 30, 40 years ago. They would hide. But here they were, demonstrating to the world just that they were there and that they did not give a damn, and they were giving the contemptuous two fingers to society. That, for me, 2 years ago, was, even though I've seen it all evolving and I'm hard-bitten and know all about this stuff, it was actually very, very depressing. And it was actually a very, very dark, ominous sign of what we're going to be dealing with, because the people who look, these people, these thugs, and an army of them in their hoodies parading into a church to celebrate this thug, out and out thug, they're the people that are let loose every week, every night, down in rural Ireland, for example, terrorizing people in their homes. And the fact that we're celebrating it was, where have we landed? You know, are we in a different planet? You know, it's very depressing sometimes.
What are your thoughts on Jerry the Monk Hutch running for election?
I thought in the beginning it was just a ruse, that it was a bit of a piss take, to tell you the truth, that he is the quintessential strong side type. He is the most inscrutable gangster of them all. He's a very colourful character. I actually like him, as well as, you know, I've described his life and crimes and murders and armed robberies and the bad things he did all his life, but I also have a grudging sort of regard for him. And he is genuinely very close to his community. However, he and his clan ultimately brought down all that terror on their community after the Regency Hotel attack. And that's a fact, and that's a state of fact, and the courts and everything. The people of the North Inner City, the people he's asking to vote for him now, are people who suffered and were terrorized during that onslaught of savagery by the Kinahan cartel to get back at the Hutches. But number one, the pundits are saying he would not be elected. Number two, it's going to make the election race very, very interesting. But three, one of the things I wonder about is he going to also buck the trend, in the sense that the man that we all thought was absolutely the strongest and most silent of them all, is he getting enamored by, is he getting turned on by the celebrity and then the notoriety to such an extent that he thinks he can run for the Dáil or whatever? Mm-hmm. I really don't know. He could be bringing a lot of unwanted attention on himself. Although, on the other side of me, having profiled him for many, many years, he could have a strategy built up behind it. He might have another ulterior motive for doing all of this. You just wouldn't know. Mm. But he certainly spiced up the election in the North Inner City. And it's very, very interesting that, originally they said, when they put out this information to his people, they said he wanted to target Sinn Féin, and particularly Mary Lou MacDonald's seat. And it's very, very interesting. There was a great piece by Philip Ryan, my colleague in the Irish Independent, the other day, where he said, isn't it extraordinary? Mary Lou MacDonald is very vociferous in attacking all these other parties and all these other, anybody who steps up to them. She was asked specific questions about Jerry Hutch, and she never wouldn't open her mouth. She would make no comment about Jerry Hutch, even though he represents organized crime. So it's, shall we say, the least we can say is that it's extremely interesting what's happening at the moment. And it'll be, I suppose, add a bit of drama for the next few weeks. And it would be churlish of me if I didn't, over the airways, wish him the best.
There are some people who will get a shock, I guess, if he's canvassing and he lands on their doorstep. They'll be used to seeing his photo in the paper for other reasons.
Well, I'd say he won't be popping into anybody's house where he's not known. He'd be too clever, and he's too well known down there as well. Like, he wouldn't want to be scaring anybody or doing that. He wouldn't do that. But I think he's going to do most of it online. He's going to be a disruptor. And one of the interesting things as well, which I was probably not surprised at, he's clear from looking at his material so far that Donald J. Trump is one of his political heroes, which that tells the story of its own as well.
So all, you know all the nicknames that all the gang members have, and particularly the gang bosses, are they nicknames that they have, or were they coined by the newspapers and that by yourselves?
Well, they were a combination of both. But we, as a newspaper, we were the first to start giving them nicknames. And the reason we did that was to navigate our ways around the defamation laws. Because this stage, this was all new ground we were breaking. So we were doing major profile pieces of criminals and really getting in-depth into who they were and what they were. But we just couldn't get across the line because there had been no precedent to name them. And that's why Cab, when it came along, helped us. But we put a lot of names on a lot of them. But others, like the Monk, that came from his own people, and the General came from gangland as well there. But the main reason I became sort of, and the Sunday War became infamous for giving them nicknames going back 20-odd years or 25 years is purely because there's a way to navigate around the libel laws. And then eventually, of course, we would take the black marks off their eyes and then say, by the way, the fella we were talking and referring to as the Penguin, his name is George Mitchell, and he's now one of the biggest drug traffickers in the world. So it was always a process, because once we started writing about a guy who's like a long-term investigation, once he made the front page at all, I was staying with him. That was it. It wasn't just a one-off thing. We were going back for more and more, because these guys, we'd get into them and then we'd start reporting on their activities, which used to drive them absolutely crazy, because they would never understand how we got the information we did about them. So that was part of the fun.
Wow. And then TV dramas, the likes of Kin and all those, Paul, do you enjoy them?
You know what? I watched Kin. I think it's very good. The one I loved the most, the one I really liked, because I know where the inspiration and I know the sources and I knew and recognised the stories, was Love Hate. Love Hate was really spectacular. I haven't watched all of Kin. I've watched parts of it and it looks good, and it really does catch the menace and the double dealing and the mendacity of these people really, really well. But I thought Love Hate was probably one of the all-time classics, because it was the world I absolutely recognised. I recognised the people, and in some cases I was able to predict what was going to happen next in the scripts on the screen in front of me, because I'd seen it before, and clearly Stuart Carlin was very, very, very well informed about criminal events and methodologies, you know.
Well, Paul, I could literally talk to you for a week. I wish you could come round to my house and have dinner and talk to me about all of this, but
Trina, you shouldn't do that across the national area.
Stop flirting with you. I know,
give me a call. I like a nice steak, not a problem, and I bring a nice bottle of wine, okay?
Paul Williams, Crooks, the stories behind the headlines. Do get yourself a copy of that. A great Christmas gift as well, Paul, is that right?
Please God, it is. Please God, it is. And thanks, Trina. It's lovely talking to you.
Thanks a million. Take care. It's Ireland's Classic Radio. Bye. Thanks, Paul. Bye-bye.